the Onyx Pathcast. I'm this week's host, Dixie Cochran, here as usual with Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
Hi. We're going to do the Skype predictive text thing.
Spaghetti.
Ahoy.
Yum.
What's your name?
Guess.
Guess. For those of you who don't know, we record these on Skype. We talk on Skype and record them separately, but Skype has introduced a predictive text feature to their texts, and we spent a good 5 minutes before the podcast just saying ridiculous things to each other that made no sense.
Yeah, it's like an Elder Scrolls Oblivion conversation, you know, when you're passing to civilians on the street and they say, "I hear there's Daedric in those hills. Mud crabs, nasty creatures. Yes, yes, bye, bye!"
Pretty much.
And the disproportionate amount of people shot in the knees with arrows.
Yes.
It does happen. Skyrim. It is Skyrim. It's the Elder Scrolls, at least. But, you know, you were close. But either way, so that's how your hosts amuse themselves.
I mean, we should be working on books, but Skype is so much more entertaining and never crashes.
Yeah, nobody tell Rich that we just do that all day. That's all we ever do.
We don't. Rich does it.
It's true, because some of the options are ridiculous. Like, you'll say something that'll be like, do you want to say inconceivable, indubitably, or good call? And I'm like, I wouldn't say any of those things to what he just said. I'm very confused.
He asked me how
it just gives
doing.
Me respect for whoever it is at the big Skype corporation in the sky programmed it, because obviously they thought, screw this, you screw the bosses, I'm just going to put a lot of gibberish in here, no one's ever going to use it.
Yeah, I feel like the one that just says "I concur" is a direct throwback to the movie Catch Me If You Can, because that's all I think of when I hear that phrase.
Yes.
Do you concur? I concur. Do you concur? Just forever.
Forever.
All right. So, I mean, none of this has anything to do with what we're talking about this week.
No.
Because this week we interview Jason Carl, who, as many of you probably know, is the producer on Vampire 5th Edition, working for White Wolf. He's also the storyteller for LA by Night. Before that, he worked at Wizards of the Coast. So we'll get into all that for the interview. This is another one with just me and Eddie, because Jason Carl is West Coast, so yeah. Matthew would have made no sense on that one.
Let's be fair. He doesn't make a lot of sense a lot of times, so...
You know what? I could be bitter, but I have an interview with Dave Brookshaw planned for the near future, and as he is in my time zone, I can feel a lot more comfortable doing it. And anyway, I speak to Jason Carl all the time. I don't need to do it for an interview.
I'm curious what Jason Carl has to say about you.
We'll see. Who knows?
Nothing but kindness.
Probably. He's a nice guy. We have, you know, shared many a booth with him at conventions, or, you know, been right next door to each other. So he definitely, bought me at least one drink at Gen Con. So I'm okay with him. All right. Well, we're doing this on a short time budget this week. So let's roll on into the interview. And welcome back. We're here today with Jason Carl, who is the Vampire 5th Edition producer and also one of the community managers. I think he's the lead community manager. He's also the CEO of By Night Studios. We have all kinds of cool stuff to talk about. I'm also here with Eddie, obviously. I guess he can talk.
Yeah, whatever, I guess.
So.
Hello, Dixie. Hello, Eddie. Thank you for having me with you.
Yeah, thank you for being here. This is exciting. We've been wanting to branch out a little bit because we have so many of our Onyx Path developers and writers to interview. But we also want to interview people that work with White Wolf, people that work with some of the LARP communities, because that's all still very important to us. So this is going to be a fun interview today, I think. We're going to keep it really casual, as usual.
You say that now.
Right.
Okay.
I do. So... if you want, we usually start by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their history with the role-playing community. So if you want, kind of, how did you get into it? What were your first games?
Yeah.
What have you done? Because I've been, reading up like I do on all of our guests. Yes, guests, I always stalk you on the internet before we interview you. And then I immediately forget everything I was going to ask you. So I know that you've worked for Wizards of the Coast. I know you've worked with the Magic the Gathering community. And, of course, tons of stuff with Vampire and Mind's Eye Society. So... yeah,
yes.
Let us know how you get into all that.
How did I get into all that? I discovered role-playing when I was a really young boy and growing up in rural Maine, of all places. when I was in junior high school at the height of the satanic panic surrounding Dungeons and Dragons, a classmate of mine introduced me to D&D. And my life was over at that point, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do and who I wanted to be and how I wanted to spend the rest of my days. Role-playing inspired me to look beyond, you know, the borders of my little rural community, which I loved and still do, but it generated an interest in literature and architecture and history and language and mythology and cool things I didn't know existed before. And I credit role-playing games with convincing me or persuading me to take big risks in leaving my little hometown and leaving my home state, getting out into the world, going to college, and pursuing what I really wanted to do through a really circuitous route. And that circuitous route led me eventually in the early 90s to Wizards of the Coast, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I discovered Wizards of the Coast through Vampire. See how that works?
Oh, wow.
Right?
Several of my friends were in the what is today known as the Mind's Eye Society, which was then known as the Camarilla, which was the oldest and first official Vampire the Masquerade and World of Darkness LARP organization. And a couple of them worked at Wizards of the Coast. And we met through this LARPing organization, and they asked me to come up and interview for a position. I did. And my first job there was working with the Magic the Gathering tournament organization. It was called the DCI at the time, the Duelist Convocation International. We thought that sounded great.
You still get DCI numbers in Magic.
Still get a DCI number, yeah. It's still there. That's what we called it.
I've got one.
And my first job was trying to figure out how to set up organized play. We knew Magic was very popular. It was really taking off. But we knew we needed organized play. We needed a way for people to formally meet, compete, and get ranked against each other in order to, you know, measure success.
Right.
And to create a program that we could easily transfer to retail stores and to bigger competitions around the world. So that was my job. My job was to come up with how do we rate and rank people? How do we have tournaments? What do tournament rules look like? What is a Pro Tour? What's a Grand Prix?
I have to say that as somebody who has a lot of friends in the Magic community and who has played, you know, not quite competitively, but has done like FNM and everything, if I had realized this whole time how instrumental you were to the way that we still all play, I have a lot of friends that probably be a little bit more starstruck than they are.
it was a kind of charmed time to be a wizard and to be a geek. There was no internet as we understand it, remember.
Right.
So the only way to generate reach was to do things physically in person. So we generated reach through personal appearances. So I traveled all over the country for a long time promoting Magic and tournament play. We started at the retail level.
Mm-hmm.
We invented the scoring system, still used today. And we instituted the Magic the Gathering World Championship and the Pro Tour and the Grand Prix system. Some of the very first professional Magic players are people I'm still in touch with today. They've gone on to have very successful careers in other fields. And it's really a privilege to have been in any small way part of what inspired them to go on and do amazing things. I think the important thing to remember about that time was that we didn't know we could fail.
Right.
We were really young and really enthusiastic and passionate, so we took crazy risks. But I remember the very first Christmas party I attended as a Wizards employee, the owner of the company, Peter Atkinson, who's one of the sweetest, kindest, and most generous men I've ever met in my life.
Absolutely he is. He's wonderful.
He is an amazing human being. He raised a glass and said, ha, 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 and, you know, in 3 years we buy TSO, which was, of course, the company that own Dungeons and Dragons. And we all laughed because we thought that was an impossibility. And then 3 years later, we bought TSR.
Yeah.
And Wizards of the Coast suddenly owned the property that changed my life as a child. And I knew I wanted to change my focus from Magic to role-playing games, to D&D. So I did.
It's always nice when you hear a guest go, well, I wanted to do this thing. So I did.
No, I mean, well, what are your options, really?
Yeah.
You can either do the thing or not.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's, you know, that's me quitting my full-time job and going to full-time freelancing. Like, I'm like, well, oh, yeah. I want to do the thing, so here I am.
But long before that happened, I was already writing freelance for White Wolf. I met Rich Dansky and Justin Achille at Dragon Con when I was working for Wizards of the Coast, and I was already LARPing with the Mind's Eye Society, or the CAM, as we called it back then. I had been involved in some of the Vampire the Eternal Struggle original set development with Matthew Burke and Sean Carnes, and we all met in a I think we met in a bar, coincidentally.
I'm
enough.
Shocked.
That would never happen, right?
I have never seen you in a bar, Jason Carl.
If I remember correctly, Justin was drinking something larger than his head, and Rich was drinking something that was on fire.
Were you at Trader Vic's?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Atlanta, yes, we were.
Sorry, I stay in the Hilton at Dragon Con, so I am intimately familiar.
And it was Rich who said, "Hey, you have a degree in medieval history, right? What are you doing with that?" I said, "Nothing." But you love Vampire, and you play Vampire LARP, and you are working at Wizards of the Coast. Would you write something for Vampire the Dark Ages? And that was my very first experience. That was my first White Wolf experience as a writer, a freelancer.
Was that Liege Lord and Lackey?
It was Liege Lord and Lackey, which Justin developed, and he was merciless. I mean, he dripped red ink all over my first draft. I felt so humbled and yet determined to prove that they had not wasted their time in asking me. My first draft was awful. It was grotesquely bad. But Justin very kindly and generously gave me a lot of time and direction and guided me into some pretty hard truths that I had to face if I wanted to do this. And fortunately, the second draft was much better and got published. But that was my first White Wolf writing experience.
That's awesome.
I'm going to shut up now and let you guys talk.
Well, actually, I was going to... It's interesting because one of the things I like to talk about in the podcast is about process. I've also been on the receiving end of Justin's work, but it was in a more kind of collaborative sense because we were both working at the time on Masquerade 20th Anniversary Edition. So I'm kind of curious. You mentioned your first draft was awful, and that's pretty fair. I think most everyone's first draft professionally ends up being really awful.
Oh, it was terrible.
What did you learn from that experience, specifically from Justin? Kind of, you said taking time and working with you on it.
The most important thing I learned was, I learned three things that I think, on the rare occasions I still write, still stick with me today.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is trust your instincts. Do the thing you thought you should have done in the first place instead of writing what you think the person on the receiving end wants to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Two, the only thing harder than writing is not writing.
Mm-hmm.
And three, preparation is at least 50% a successful RPG manuscript.
Oh, yes.
Do the work, do the research, read the books, watch the movies, absorb the media, get in the mood. Whatever it takes to understand the material and the audience that's going to enjoy it, do those things and your writing will be better.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
he really taught me about audience. He made me think about the people who would be reading and using the work, which really hadn't occurred to me in any meaningful way before.
Right, because I mean, when you're writing for RPGs instead of writing, for instance, a novel, which we've talked about this on our freelance panels and our freelance podcast, like you're making a toolkit for people to use. You are writing fiction for yourself, you know.
Absolutely, and once you write it, once it's published, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to the readers, the users, the players, the storytellers. They're going to do things with it you never imagined. Mm-hmm. Never anticipated, and are probably better than the things you thought of.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, that's something that Eddie's talked about when he's been running like Pugmire playtest or Monarchies of Mal playtest, where it's like they took this in a totally different direction, but it was fun.
Oh yeah, absolutely. jumping ahead a little bit, but I'm watching people doing streamings of Vampire the Masquerade, Monarchies of Mao, Pugmire, all those games, and watching them take it in, again, different directions than anticipated is always, to me at least, very exciting, because then it's not just this thing stuck in your head. It's, oh, wow, other people are engaging with it, and now it's become its own living, thriving thing outside of myself.
Isn't that marvelous, though?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah,
I think that's that. It's a wonderful feeling. I think that somewhere along in the last decade or so, my mission shifted dramatically into trying to do all I could to make sure that this thing we love is passed on to future generations of people who will also love it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always thrilled when I see actual play podcasts and streams and blog accounts of how they're using the things that we all wrote.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to talk about this later, but since this is like the perfect segue, I know you've been doing the Vampire 5th Edition Twitch stream for Geek & Sundry, LA by Night. How's that experience been for you? Because this is one of the first big Vampire 5th streams, obviously, since the game just came out at Gen mm-hmm. Con.
This has been a fantastic experience from beginning to end. Geek & Sundry are great partners, and when we all got together to start talking about this well over a year ago, we imagined many different formats that it could take before we settled on the one that we have now. And I didn't originally plan to be involved as a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
That came about not quite accidentally, but very hurriedly and at the last possible because we had a very different format and storyteller in mind. And that just didn't work out, unfortunately.
Sure.
But when it didn't work out, we were kind of between a rock and a hard place. They said, can you do this? I said, I have no idea. I've never done streaming tabletop before. I've done one-shots on streams for friends. I don't really know what I'm doing. And it was either that or don't do it.
Right.
So,
well, you know,
evidently it worked.
I mean, if you've ever run a campaign, it's just, you know, run the campaign with a camera on you on some level. Like,
well, that's the key. You have to forget about the camera. You have to forget that there are people watching and just tell the story.
Yeah,
you do make different decisions than you would if it was your home campaign or your home chronicle at the table and there is no one watching, but in a very real sense, as long as you are engaged with your players and delivering, you know, great emotional drama that makes everybody at the table enthused and engaged, your viewers are going to love it too.
Yeah. Are there any moments so far in the Chronicle you're running that have surprised you? You're talking about, you know, players surprising you with things.
Oh, yeah. How I do this is a little bit unusual, maybe. Each week I prepare a story. I know where the story is going in general in very high-level terms, and I share it with the players. And I say, hey, look, I got two story beats I want to hit, just one at A and B, and, you know, please give them some special attention. Apart from that, go do what you want. And they always surprise me. They always take the story in directions that I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, that's true of any tabletop experience, and any LARP experience, too.
Absolutely.
Two lessons I've learned about that is, one, players will go to any length to cover your most egregious story lapse. They will make connections where none exist. They will be better than anything you ever thought of.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. It's like, wow, yeah. Yeah, actually, I planned that totally. Yeah. from the very beginning. And two, players trust you with their fun when you're a storyteller. And that is the highest compliment they can possibly give you.
Right.
Fun is a precious, precious commodity in these days.
Yeah, we've gotten a little philosophical about what is fun a couple times. We may even do a whole episode on that.
I think that's a really good idea, because I think that the perception of what is fun has changed radically since the advent of the internet, and certainly the advent of social media. And I don't know. When we do LA by Night on Friday nights and we see how many people are joining us, we're blown away, because they could be anywhere. They could choose to spend their Friday night any way they want, doing anything they wanted to in a world of infinite possibility, especially when you're a geek or a fan. Mm-hmm. This world is your oyster. They could be doing anything at all, and yet they choose to spend it with us. That's That's a huge privilege.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, it's particularly with a game like Vampire the Masquerade, where it's you know, always been from day one a game of personal horror. That was the tagline for forever. So there's, you know, it's not quite fun so much as catharsis at times. But as modern culture gets more interconnected and people share stories more, and with certain movements coming out and the like, it sometimes gets a little harder to kind of find that balance. But I mean, at the end of the day, as long as people are enjoying it, it can be the kind of fun of like going to a haunted house or a roller coaster where you're scared, quote unquote, but at the end you're going, oh my God, that was an amazing, huge rush. Even though at the moment, maybe you're not having fun in the traditional, you know, a sense, but at the end it's like, oh, that was a really amazing experience, and I feel such a good sense of relief and catharsis after having experienced that.
Well, yeah, I mean, fun is entirely subjective. Like, yeah. Some people have fun being scared. Like, they like that adrenaline. Some people, like, I've got friends who won't step foot into a haunted house, whereas I used to work at them, because I enjoyed scaring people. and I actually like that little thrill of being like, ah, that was scary, because it doesn't happen to me as often anymore, as I've gotten older and more jaded and consumed a lot of horror literature and horror media. So it's still nice when something can actively creep me out. But that's not for everybody. Like, one of my roommates will not watch anything horror. We had to talk her into Buffy, because she was afraid Buffy was going to be too scary. And even while watching it, there's a couple scenes every now and then where she's like, ooh, and I'm like, really? Like, these 1998 special effects are getting you? All right. But she's just not a horror person. So, yeah, everyone's got their things. But that's why it would be fun to do a whole episode on it, because what's fun for me might not be fun for you, Eddie, and what's, you know, fun for Matthew might not be fun for any of us. So, get this, Matthew.
Well, where to begin? we don't have the kind of time. So
we love Matthew.
let me say this about that: working with Matthew Dawkins has been one of the great privileges. He was a writer, as you know, a contributor to B5 Core Book and the Camera Guide that we're publishing very soon. And what a consummate professional.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just absolutely, just a joy to work with. That's the kind of writer everybody should want to work with at all times.
Right.
Yeah. Matthew's always, you know, really good at knowing what he needs to do and knowing where he needs to be and what needs to happen. Like, we've even talked about, as I've been learning the process of development and everything, we've talked about me like shadowing him for a day, essentially just like hanging out on Skype while we work, so I can be like, how do you do this? Because I'm still having issues, you know, structuring my day. And he's just fantastic at all of that. Like, every time we turn around and he takes on a new project for us, we're like, what? Another one? but he keeps turning them around, so.
He keeps turning them around, and I mean, he seems to have a limitless capacity for the work that he loves, and so more power to him.
So let's dive into Vampire 5th Edition a little bit, because I know that's something that a lot of our listeners probably want to hear about. If you want to talk at all about the process, or about just changes that were made for 5th that you're really happy with, is there anything specific that kind of jumps out at you?
I'm happy with so much of it. I'm happy that we were able to make sure that it was a continuation and not a reboot. It's not a restart of the World of Darkness. It's a carry-on.
Mm-hmm.
We pick up where the previous editions have left off and move the story forward into the modern night. And that was really important to me, because I felt very strongly that the community that's been supporting Vampire the Masquerade for, how long is it? Is it 27 years now?
Yep.
Am I counting correctly?
Yeah, because it was 1991.
Their support and enthusiasm demonstrated really clearly that it was the story and the emotions generated by the story that were the key to whatever resonated with people in Vampire the Masquerade. So it was very important to me that it be a continuation of the thing that we love. And I was super pleased that we were able to do that. I'm really... I'm in awe of the Hunger rules. Kareem Mumar and Carl Bergstrom did the initial work on the Hunger system.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just in awe of the simple genius of it. It's amazing. The Hunger rules, I was skeptical at first. I was worried, like, oh gosh, is this too much? Are Is this a game about eating people? What does this say about the state of vampires in the modern world when they're all about hunger? But it works beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
And the reinforcement of the core theme, a beast I am, lest a beast I become, through the hunger rules, I think is just beautiful to watch and play.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the things that resonates most with the LA by Night viewers. They really appreciate how the rising tension and the risk, V5 has a risk subgame, basically a almost Vegas style Russian roulette type of deal.
With yeah, a push your luck mechanic, yeah.
How far can I push the beast before I have to pay it?
Right.
And I really like how that supports all the core themes of Vampire.
Yeah, I think that's a really elegant solution to something that, I mean, we've been playing for, you know, 20 years, and so many games I've been in just kind of hand-waved feeding. Like, yeah.
Well, sure,
yeah,
never,
okay,
it
you
never
fed,
really
you're fine.
Paid off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when the original game hit the shelves, the blood pool was the obvious solution.
Yeah. Right.
It made perfect sense for design technology at the time. And even then, I think it's important to remember it was revolutionary.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that design has moved forward since then is not really meant as a pejorative or a critique about that original manifestation of the core theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm certainly not trying to say that, like, you know, it was bad. It's just something that groups, I think, tended to kind of forget about after a while, as they got into their other stories. And I think that the idea of not allowing them to forget about it is a really nice, you know, change.
I think it's a good change, and I think that the stories that I see players telling in live streams and podcasts and actual play, let me back up and say this about that instead.
Okay.
What I think really impresses me is how seamlessly storytellers and players are blending all the things we have always loved about Vampire the Masquerade and its core themes with the new pillars of play, which are hunger, of course,
mm-hmm.
The Gehenna War,
mm-hmm.
the bizarre, strange, supernatural pull of the elders away to the Middle East to do whatever is happening over there. And so suddenly making Ancilla and Neonate characters supremely important to play.
Right.
The rise of the Second Inquisition and the threat that they represent to vampire existence, and the War of Ages. When I was, when I was first introduced to Vampire, both in tabletop and in LARPing, the War of Ages was the core conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Young versus old, elder versus neonate, anarch versus Camarilla. And that was a thrilling and very timely emotional flashpoint for all of us back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really thrilled to see that come front and center again. If you pull back and you look at the Camarilla and the Anarchs and their conflict in modern media terms,
mm-hmm.
the Camarilla have become House of Cards meets Eyes Wide Shut,
mm-hmm.
and the Anarchs have become The Wire meets Scarface.
Mm-hmm.
Stringer Bell is now the ultimate Anarch.
Absolutely.
And I think that President Underwood is the ultimate Camarilla.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that by being able to tell those stories in a way that resonates in a very contemporary way makes the experience a lot more powerful and meaningful and accessible to all kinds of players who maybe never have experienced Vampire before.
Right, yeah. I mean, even though the, you know, politics have shifted back and forth in the real world and in pop culture, there's always something political you can kind of pin Vampire to make your players relate to it or to, you know, let them understand it a little bit better. Because I know, you know, I'm trying to think of some right now, but there are definitely media inspirations we were playing back in the day. You know, for me, it was the early 2000s when I was really playing a lot. There are always movies and books and things that we kind of like tried to rope it, you know, like rope it to make sure we understood like what was going on. And yeah, I think those are great analogies because
Oh, yeah, I think media has always informed how we play, and
Oh, yeah.
how you play is often about where you take your inspirations from.
Yep, which is why, you know, I spent a long time playing a Malkavian who was pretty much Drusilla from Buffy, but a little less crazy.
Oh my gosh, Drusilla has been my not so secret crush for about 20 years, so be still my beating heart.
Also, Juliet Landau, she's been at conventions and stuff. She's always very sweet too, which is nice.
She is so kind and so generous, and she's always so so happy to share her time with fans. Wonderful.
I really love how much of this podcast has become let's love on people that aren't here. So let's just keep talking about how great people are.
Well, I think there's a lot of love to share. This is Absolutely. A big extended family. Funny. Twitter has become the central gathering point for tabletop role players. And I have reconnected with so many lapsed vampire fans through Twitter in the last 6 months that I'm just astonished. It blows me away. People I haven't heard from in 20 years have found me on Twitter and saying, do you remember when we LARPed in Tacoma, Washington, or Seattle, mm-hmm. or Portland, or the very first Grand Masquerade that really affected me, and I've been a fan ever since. When those moments happen, you get a greater sense of the impact this has, and you, I think, are re-inspired and recommitted to making sure that there is something to hand off to the next generation.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, I'm sure you've experienced this too, but it's also very powerful in other ways. Like, I don't know, I can't count the number of times people have come up to me and it's like, Vampire the Masquerade helped me to come out of the closet to my family. It helped me to overcome my alcohol addiction. It affects them more just, oh, it was a fun game and I remember fun people, but also for some people, it's a very substantial impact on their day-to-day lives. And that's also really inspiring and humbling, I've found, too.
Definitely. I really liked at the top of the show, we were talking with, you know, Jason about kind of how, you know, D&D Vampire changed your life on some level, because we just did a whole episode about that, about what you can get from gaming, and how all three of us, all of, you know, the main hosts of the show, like all of us had, you know, weird childhoods or whatever, and we all used role playing to get out of it.
You don't say.
I know, right? Shocking, right?
You don't say. What a shock.
I've not met anybody yet in the industry who is like, yeah, I was a popular jock in high school, and then I found D&D. Like, I just haven't met those people. I know they exist, but like 90% of people I know.
I played football and I was in the drama club and nobody knew what to do with me. And I think D&D just sort of cemented the weird trifecta.
Yeah, no, I was definitely like a theater kid, weird kid. It was fun though.
I enjoyed football and basketball and baseball, but I also enjoyed drama and speech and debate. And if I hadn't tried to bridge both worlds, D&D and role-playing games would have spoken to me the way they did.
Yeah. I can see that. I mean, it's definitely a good way, you know, to put yourself in someone else's shoes and to learn more about yourself through, you know, playing other characters.
Oh, sure. And that's the great gift that role-playing gives us, right? The ability to see the world through another's eyes, the ability to, or the privilege of shifting your view and perceiving problems, issues, emotions, situations through the lens of somebody else's point of view.
Mm-hmm. You know, I always think that's very important.
Yeah. Mayhem. Mayhem is important.
Yeah, also mayhem. It's like...
Also mayhem.
It's like role-playing games can teach you empathy and also arson.
And arson and... what have you been watching the latest LA by Night? that's funny you should...
I haven't seen the most recent one because I unfortunately had some, you know, work things to do. But is there arson happening now? Because I need to catch up.
Arson has happened at least twice now.
Excellent. And,
it's been a wonderful and wild ride.
What's it been like to have some of the special guests on this show too? Like I personally was completely surprised when Mark Muir showed up because I'm a huge fan of his.
Mark, I am a huge fan of Mark. Mark is a constant. And a gifted actor, and that came about very, very abruptly and organically. And it happened that streaming, as you may know, is the Wild West of media mm-hmm. right now. Yeah. It is wide open, and there are very few rules. It is. I think it is very difficult to make this analogy to anyone who is not, I mean, even we are too young, you and me, Eddie, are too young to remember the heyday of live TV in the 50s.
Yeah, although I would say streaming is kind of where podcasting was 10 years ago, too, to a certain degree.
It certainly is the Wild West maverick of media entertainment, but it is growing hugely. When there is an important esports live streaming tournament online, millions of people watch.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Critical Role has, I don't think it's possible to overstate the importance of Critical Role in bringing new people into our hobby, and into our lives, into our friendships, and into our business.
Mm-hmm.
The streaming is young but extraordinarily powerful media.
Yep.
And it happens at light speed. Mark came on as a guest within the span of 48 hours.
That's awesome.
But he happened to be doing things at Geek and Sundry where I was. We talked about his love for Vampire the Masquerade and Werewolf the Apocalypse and World of Darkness in general. We looked at where could we bring you in as a character. And I realized, oh my gosh, we have this great subplot with Nelly the Traitor, Nelly G. Cynthia Marie, and we realized this is a chance to expand what would have been a throwaway subplot and be extended into a very important storyline. Mm-hmm. And Mark was totally down for it. He was a superb professional. He really brought the solid role playing. If you've seen episode two, you've seen him do it. And now his character Chaz is very much a part of the narrative. And we'll be hearing more from him in the future.
Ooh, that's exciting. Ooh. But yeah, no, I was...
Oh, he's going to give Nelly a hard way to go. I mean, come on, Diablerie, that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, her choices are bad and worse. And Mark was instrumental in making sure that paid off dramatically. The thing about streaming is that it's not unlike the old radio dramas.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They're live, they are extemporaneous, and you don't really know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You can put down all the parameters you want, but in the moment, in the excitement, you don't know. But we've been so fortunate in our guest cast. Allison Jaffe as Carver, Annabelle Sire, mm-hmm. was extraordinary. And I don't think it's any secret that Talzin has been a Vampire the Masquerade fan for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Satine Phoenix as our very first representative of the ministry, the Setites, mm-hmm. pretty much brought the house down last week. And I think that everybody is wondering, what is the ministry's relationship to the Anarchs going forward? And that will be revealed in the Anarch setting book we'll release in a very short period of time.
I already haven't. I mean, I have the Word document.
Well, you're in a unique position to judge whether Satine brought the ministry to life or not.
I think that Satine is just kind of a perfect Setite anyway. Just even her looks are perfect for that. But I've never seen her play a character poorly. So.
Oh, I never have either. Satine's a dear friend, and I'm always delighted to. Make sure that she is involved in whatever the World of Darkness is doing. But I'm not sure she really is a Setite.
I don't know if that's her, actual plan.
She might be a La Sombra. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, then she can come hang out with me.
when Chicago by Night hits the shelves, we'll find out.
Yeah, well, that's honestly, for our listeners, that's why I have the Anarch text, is because I'm checking things against it for Chicago by Night, which is, of course, our upcoming V5 book that I'm super excited about.
I am so crazy excited for Chicago by Night. I cannot wait to run that on a stream somewhere, whether it's I can't wait to run it.
Yeah, and it's definitely very much, it's a great toolbox. There's, so many plot hooks, because, of course, the Matthew Dawkins rule is never write a sentence without a plot hook in it. Mm-hmm. So just like everything that he develops, much like Beckett's Jihad Diary, which was, of course, him and Neil Price, pretty much every paragraph is going to be like, here's a thing you can do. Here's a person you can talk to.
And, And it applies both immediately and personally in all ways. I looked at Beckett's Jihad Diary really carefully before I set up the plot for LA by Night, and we took one of the recommended plot lines straight from the diary and put it right into the stream.
And that's what we were
Nice.
trying to create, was a book that was not only a fun read, because it really is just a fun read. If anybody wants to, read some vampire meta plot and not do anything with it, that's fine. But
Actually,
It's
speaking of meta
not.
plot, this is now the perfect time for our obligatory Bloodlines reference. How much of Vampire Bloodlines has impacted LA by Night?
How much? Wow, where to begin?
All of
I
it.
figured that was some kind of the answer, which is like,
We
yes, all
don't
of
have that kind of time, Eddie, so
it.
let me say this about that. The gameplay and the experience that Bloodlines introduced, I think, was underappreciated at the time, but now we see that it is very much a modern or postmodern classic.
Yes.
It's continuously cited as one of the most influential RPG PC games of all time, and the way it conveyed the thematic truths of the World of Darkness, I think, has been unparalleled and untouched ever since. So I'm definitely drawing on elements of Bloodlines for LA by Night, the stream. Some of the baronies have been consolidated. Therese is still in charge of Santa Monica, but her barony has expanded. She's got Venice, she's got Ocean Park, she's got Long Beach, she's got the whole basically west of LA.
Nice.
Isaac Abrams is still the Baron of Hollywood, but as we've seen, he is also the Baron of the Valley and various other things that are distasteful. Nines Rodriguez is still holding on to downtown and various environs, but all the other barons have kind of been absorbed or eliminated. And trying to combine the story of Bloodlines with the V5 story pillars has been one of the great joys and privileges of my storytelling career. And I'm hoping, what I hope is that people who watch take what we're dropping and make it their own. Spin it off into their own LA by Night stories, their own Long Beach stories, their own Bloodline stories. Take it as inspiration. It's quasi-canonical, but not 100%.
Like all tabletop games, it's like everything's, some people have sliding scales of how close they are to the canon. I know some people who were heavily entrenched in the Masquerade meta plot, and lots of people who are like, they just ignored most of it and just did their own thing. So everything's kind of somewhere on their scale between absolutely canonical because it's in a book somewhere versus we're ignoring select chunks, so.
Yeah, I think that what I want to be fair and I want to be honest. I think that the most humbling thing about the stream that we're doing and how we're trying to connect the old World of Darkness to V5 is when fans who once loved the World of Darkness or once loved Vampire the Masquerade, but went away for whatever reason, have found it again, have rediscovered it, and found out that, oh, the thing that I loved is still here and it's still awesome and I can love it again or still love it. To me, that's the most humbling moment because there are so many people who enjoyed Bloodlines but never found their way to tabletop role-playing game. But now is the time of tabletop RPG. It's ascendant in a way that has been unparalleled in the past. And so if we can make that bridge between people who love the PC game and who are now just now discovering the tabletop game, I think that's awesome for our community because that means thousands and thousands of new players to play with.
I'm actually always surprised when I meet somebody who knows Bloodlines but doesn't realize it's based on a tabletop. I had that happen a while back where I popped into a girl stream who was playing Bloodlines on Twitch, and I was like, I don't have anything to do. I'll watch this for a minute. And I, ended up talking to them for a little bit because there were only like six people in the room. It was a very late night just hanging out stream. And I like said, kind of what I've worked on, and they're like, oh, it's a book? And I'm like, yes, it's lots of hundreds of books. Hundreds of books.
You don't say.
I mean, we've heard that at conventions too, and when we've because often Onyx Path is right next to White Wolf at various gaming conventions. And I've definitely had people come up and be like, "Oh, I remember White Wolf from the 90s," and it's like the books never stopped coming out really.
Right.
Just so you know. Like, you've got some catching up to do, because they, you know, played from 93 to 99 or whatever, and then got out of it. And it's like, okay, well, here it is, almost 20 years later. we have this new fancy 5th edition, we have this Beckett's Jihad Diary, like, we've got things you can look at now, if you want to get back into it. But it's always so fascinating to hear.
It's a big challenge. It is wonderful to hear, but it's a big challenge because we live in the age of media where fans are accustomed to media in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. And White Wolf is now a transmedia company, so we are very much dedicated to telling our stories across broad spectrum of products, not just tabletop role-playing games and streaming, but board games, card games, video games, of course, and perhaps even, you know, television and other linear media as well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest challenges that we all have, White Wolf, Onyx Path, Black Knight Studios, is helping our fans find their way back to the thing that they loved and explain it to them in a way that they understand in the shadow of modern transmedia.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I definitely see
Not
that.
An easy challenge.
Yeah.
So I figure that's your problem, you guys.
We'll take care of that for
good
you.
Good luck, suckers.
Fine.
Excellent, excellent. My work here is done.
Well, so
wonderful.
We're getting close to time, so that actually segues back into what one of my last questions was going to be, which is what do White Wolf or you personally or whatever kind of want the future of this property to be? What are your like dream scenarios for that?
Wow. How serious do you want me to be, Dixie?
I mean, it's your answer. You can be as serious as you'd like.
Let me say this about that. Personally, you know, I'm an elder vampire, and I've been doing this for a long time. Half my adult life,
mm-hmm.
as a matter of fact. And if I'm lucky, if I'm extraordinarily lucky, I'll get to do this for another 25 to 30 years. Maybe. And for me, personally, the goal is that when I'm not here, make sure that there is something to pass off that is substantial to people who don't know about it yet, but who can discover it and love it the way we do now. That's the whole goal and the entire mission. And that can take many different forms: LARP, tabletop, streaming, books, TV, film, creating card games. You know, every manifestation of the World of Darkness is just another love letter to the fan, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my personal mission is to make sure that any waking time and productive time I have left is spent crafting those things so that there is a torch to pass. I think for White Wolf, it's fair to say that is also their mission, but more immediately, their goal is to make sure that there are beautiful stories to tell across a number of media. Mm-hmm. That can impact the world. We very much believe at White Wolf that the original mission of Vampire the Masquerade and the World of Darkness is very relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an examination of the evils and the troubles of the world through the lens of the monster. Exploring personal horror means confronting inconvenient and unpleasant truths, mm-hmm. and learning from them. Understanding the darkness within ourselves and within our culture and our society makes us better able to identify it and fight it and defeat it in real life. That hasn't changed at all. And I think White Wolf is still very, very much committed to that mission.
Right. I mean, that's something that White Wolf has been about since day one. I mean, which I think is awesome.
Absolutely day one. And I think it's hugely important. And I think it's awesome. Look. Wow, there's a weird noise on the line.
Yeah, sorry. There's been a little bit of cutting in and out. So if any of our listeners hear a bit of, you know, silence every now and then, I apologize. And
well, I have room for the awkward silence song now.
Awkward silence time.
It's Los Angeles. It's L.A. It's Therese down in Santa Monica. She's got this weird technology thing. I don't know.
Weird sounds are fun on the podcast. We're into them. You know, why not? I've had sirens at my old place. It was great.
Whoa, awesome. No, right? Weird. It's been weirdly quiet for an LA morning. No sirens, no helicopters.
No nothing's on.
You have no idea. This is the loudest city on the planet.
Really?
Yeah. No. I've heard. I've stayed in New York for a time, and I've heard that certain parts of LA are worse.
Wow,
it's incredible. But you both have to visit me out here, so I can show you around, take you down to Santa Monica to the pier and downtown and all the iconic locations that are important in the world of darkness.
Absolutely, that'd be
wonderful. That'd be awesome someday.
Do a little kind of wide tour.
The wide tour, which ends at Cloak and Dagger, of course
it does.
The most Vampire the Masquerade club experience ever.
Yeah, I'm jealous every time I see Instagram photos of either you or our mutual friend Molly there, because I'm like, I want to be there.
You should be here. You belong here like no other.
Oh, I'm such an East Coaster, though.
You know, the minute you can replicate that experience on the East Coast, I'll visit you until then. I like my odds.
Well, okay, so... probably getting towards the end of this. So where can people find you, follow you on social media if they want to do that?
Jason? I really want to? Okay. I would set your fire, but if you must. I am the same name on all social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you name it. I am Vampires and Vino.
Yep.
The word Vampires, the letter N, and Vino, V-I-N-O.
Awesome.
That's one of the two of my great passions are vampires and wine.
I am also into both of those things. So
true. A good life, right?
Yeah, no, very much so.
It's a life well spent.
Is there anything you wanted to leave us with? You think we covered everything you wanted to talk about?
I just want to say thank you. I want to say thank you to you and Eddie for having me with you. I want to thank the Onyx Path, which is a daily inspiration to me in doing what we do. I think that not for companies like Onyx Path and Bonai Studios, the torch might have sputtered and died long ago, and I'm grateful to work for Paradox and for White Wolf, but I don't want to neglect companies like Onyx Path and By Night, because these are the companies that were standing outside in the rain, holding up their lighters, waiting for the show to start, and making sure that the show didn't go anywhere while it enjoys its second act.
Right.
So thank you both very much.
Thank you. That's a wonderful way to put that. Because, I was a fan of all the work Onyx Path was doing while, you know, nobody was really doing much with the official White Wolf name. And I'm glad that Paradox is doing something with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad
that White Wolf is a thing again.
It's very much a thing. You have seen nothing yet.
But I'm also very, very grateful to, you know, be able to continue to work on the properties. So I like the relationship we have. So, well, awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, Jason. And
thank you both very much indeed. I really appreciate the gift of your time.
And I'm going to shoot us back over to the three-host format now. Bye. And we're back.
Yay.
Wasn't that fun?
It was fun.
I had fun. Yeah, I actually...
It was fun being, you know, on the periphery.
You got talked about in glowing terms.
I did, glowingly. Wasn't that nice? Wasn't Jason nice about me? And, you know, it is only gentlemanly to reciprocate. He has been a fantastic colleague on V5. It's always lovely working with Jason. Always lovely collaborating with him. And in my brief time as the community manager person at White Wolf, we certainly shared a lot of good ideas, implemented as many of them as we could. So, all the best to him.
Yeah, no, I always enjoy talking to Jason at conventions and stuff. He's an interesting guy. And honestly, until we were about to do the interview, I didn't realize how much work he had done with Wizards in the past. So that was fun to talk about.
Yeah, it was actually, I did not realize how instrumental he was in basically how we play competitive Clipper card games today. I mean, he was very instrumental at the beginning of that, so that was really, really interesting to hear.
Yeah, so I mean, I used to work at a comic shop, the comic and game store, as many of them are, and one of the things that I helped run was Friday Night Magic. And yeah, it's so funny hearing that, you know, they implemented like DCI numbers and things, and I'm like, we still use that. Like, we use the same ranking system that you would, you know, helped invent back in the 90s, so... That was super, super cool. Also, the fact that he worked on so many D&D books that I'm familiar with from 3rd edition, I'm like, oh, hey, I recognize all of these.
Yeah, and I always find it interesting when we talk to people like this, because it seems like when you talk to people like Neil or Jason or Rich, they kind of get known for a thing. Yeah. And digging into the other stuff that people may not be aware of. And it's like, it all kind of blurs together. And it's like, you know, now there are lots of people who only know me through Pugmire, don't even know about my Vampire the Masquerade work, or certainly not stuff like Cartoon Action Hour or whatever. So hearing other people like, oh yeah, I had all this career beforehand that I'm still very proud of and like to talk about, because no one asks them those questions.
Yeah, that actually came up a little bit in the Exalted Slack yesterday. I think I tend to forget that, you know, everybody at, you know, Classic White Wolf kind of worked on a lot of the properties.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were talking about, I'm working on one of the books right now, and in the city of Nexus in Exalted, there is a district called the Nexus District.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of going to the slide going, is this correct? Is there actually a district called Nexus District in Nexus? Because that doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys looked it up, and he's like, oh, yep, that was in Scavenger Sons. It's Justin Achilles' fault. And I was like, it's funny because I think everybody thinks of Justin Achilles as like the vampire guy.
Right.
You know? But, you know, apparently Scavenger Sons was his fault, and also he is the reason that we have Nexus District. So you can send your angry postcards to Justin Achilles.
he has received many in his time. It was funny, actually, because I was on my work on Chicago. I was having to rewrite one of the characters from Chicago by Night's second edition to put into this one, mm-hmm. this version. And looking at their previous backstory in the old book from what I guess second edition came out in around 96, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
And the character is said to have been born to the McDonagh clan in Scotland. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a bit self-referential there, Chris, because Chris McDonagh was one of the art directors at White Wolf. Mm-hmm. Back at the time, and you occasionally just find these things where, yeah, you can trace a writer or an artist or a member of production's fingerprints all over the work, even if you don't usually associate them with the text, you know, because Chris is an artist.
Oh yeah, there's definitely references peppered kind of throughout various projects. Every now and then I'll be flipping back to research something and be like, I see what you did there. I see that you put yourself in this book. But I mean, you know, to be fair, we've all done stuff like that on some level. It's kind of fun sometimes. I never put my name into anything because my name is too obvious.
Right.
Like, if I you know, put a character named Dixie in anything, people are going to be like, well, that's obviously Dixie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I might stick my last name in something.
Well, I wanted to put a character called Dixie in one of my pieces of work, and this was just around the time you had started working for Onyx Path in earnest, and then I thought, I can't now. Because of you. So it's your fault.
What? Where are you going to put a Dixie? There aren't many Dixies in the world anymore.
I think there was going to be a Dixie in Beckett's Jihad Diary.
Oh, that would have been cool.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean...
Would have. Should have, would have,
could have. Technically is a Dixie in Beckett's Jihad Diary, just in the credits.
That's true. And that's the most important.
I tried to work...
That's what we tell
I tried to work a sideways reference to you in Pirates of Pugmire, but turns out it was accidentally a real place, so...
Yeah, no, I actually... Which was the bay you had chosen? It was actually called like...
It was Dixon Cove.
Yep, yeah. I thought that might have been you doing that.
Yeah.
Probably because I was teasing you about Port Matthew being an actual place.
Right.
Within the game world.
The best place.
I was like, how can Matthew get to port? Not me. But yeah, that's a real place. And then everybody would be like, well, Pugmire's obviously set in Honduras. And it's like, no, it's not. It's set in the ephemeral land.
That would be a... Yeah, it would be, you know, everyone, when they look back on the Forgotten Realms, and they say, Mazdaka is clearly the Americas, and Karatur is supposed to be the Far East. Having a game set in Honduras via a fantasy sort of veil, I think would be fairly innovative, actually.
Yeah.
So do it. Do it.
It's back in the book.
You have my blessing.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Matthew. I did not realize that you were in charge of creative direction on Pugmire now.
We did ever.
The last guy wasn't doing a very good job.
You know I'm right here, right?
Oh,
you took a swipe at me before the damn interview. It just took me about an hour to come up with a riposte.
And another thing.
Give me my moment.
It's like when you go back home, you go to sleep, you wake up the next day, and it's like, oh, I should have said that thing.
Exactly.
So
I was asleep during the interview.
So because this is coming out just before Halloween, we didn't actually do like a special Halloween episode. Is anybody doing anything for Halloween before we wrap up? You want to do anything cool? Any costumes?
I am not, sadly, because the weekend after Halloween, we are moving house, so it's going to be just kind of all hands on deck for a while.
Yeah, maybe something this weekend.
Which can be a scary moment. You know, I never enjoy moving house. Wouldn't really see it as a Halloween movie.
True. That's always fun.
I may be going to a party. Myself and a couple of friends are going as different generations of... I think we're going for Madonna now. Initially, it was going to be Britney Spears, but I think we're just going as different eras of Madonna.
I desperately need to see photos of this when it happens.
We take our costuming very seriously.
My boyfriend and I are going to a party this weekend, and we are dressing as gender-bent Beetlejuice and Lydia, because it makes his costume super easy, because all he has to do is wear all black and a hat, and I get to do crazy things with liquid latex, which I always enjoy. So I actually did Beetlejuice last year, for anyone that follows me on Instagram, so I'm just like doing it again in a different location, because I'm very lazy. and then also, if anyone listening is in the Philadelphia area, I will be at Dracula's Ball on Halloween night in Philly to see a couple of bands and dress up like a vampire. So that'll be fun.
I mean, it just goes back to our constant interview about dressing on brand, so...
I do dress on brand, just in general. Like, I'm definitely not wearing anything colorful right now, except my hair. Cool. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Eddie, where can people find you? Let's do the social thing.
Just about anywhere at Eddie Fate, EddyFate, or if you want to follow my professional work, you can follow that at Pugsteady, or you can just go to pugsteady.com.
Cool. And Matthew?
You can find me on the Onyx Path forum as The Gentleman Gamer, on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer, and on Twitter as Clack Click Bang. And I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who posted comments on our last podcast episode that went up as Q&A.
Yeah.
Things that we can address in a future podcast, because we will get to them and answer your questions.
Yes, I was going to say, we'll get to those at a later date. Probably not next couple episodes, maybe the one after. We'll block out some time to get some of those answered, because I love that you have questions for us. It's amazing. You can find me online most places at Dixie Cyanide. You can find, you know, all of us at theonyxpath.com, obviously. And as always, many worlds, one podcast.
Let me just verify that it is recording. Yes, I'm seeing recording.
I am also recording.
I am recording.
I'm making sure I am jumping into the yellow. I'm going to move my mic a little bit.
I am recording. Are you recording? We sound like dogs talking to each other. Bark, bark, bark. Are you a dog? I'm a dog. I am also a dog. Are you a dog? I am also a dog. I figure that's what they're saying.
I mean, pretty much. I think that's how dogs talk. Just, yeah.
Hey, dog.
I don't think they have a big vocabulary.
I mean, Eddie's the expert on dog talk.
That's true. I clearly know absolutely everything about dogs.
I like to poop. Do you like to poop?
I think it's great.